Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Next family game night, you can forget about that stack of board games in the closet. Instead, pull out a tablet or smartphone and download some family-friendly game apps. But here's the hard part. Which games? Joining us to sort that out, Ginny Goodmanson, kid tech columnist for USA Today and the author of the For Dummies book, iPad Apps for Kids. Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
So what's the general criteria for a good family game app?
So I think the general criteria is that it's A, fun, B, easy to figure out how to play.
Mm-hmm.
And in our household, actually, we're looking for something that's going to induce some laughter.
And let's start off with Heads Up. You gave that a thumbs up.
I sure did. So Heads Up is coming from the Ellen DeGeneres show. It is a game that she has played repeatedly over the years, and they finally turned it into an app. And the concept behind it is it's a charades kind of game, but with a twist. And the twist is that instead of a person acting out something so that everybody can figure it out, it is that the crowd acts out and the person is holding the iPhone, the iPad, is trying to guess what everybody is acting out. And so the way it works, and the reason it's called Heads Up, is that the one person's designated to have the device and they put it above their head. And so what's fun about it is then it broadcasts what the crowd is supposed to act out, which makes it an interesting use of technology. But it goes farther than that, Anne.
Okay.
What's really exciting about it is that while the crowd is busy acting out and the person is holding this device above their head, the device is actually taking video of everybody acting out.
Oh, that's great.
So it's just, I mean, and people get into the moment. I mean, they are madly trying to, you know, convince somebody what they're trying to show them by actions. And so at the end, when you're all finished, you get to look at the video together.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, it's funny just watching the person next to you do silly things. But when you catch it on video, oh, my goodness, the laughter really ensues.
Does the group work together or are they individually?
And what I found in testing, and I tested it with a wide range of ages, like an 84-year-old grandma down to, you know, the 6-year-old or even younger, they can get into the fun of it. Mm-hmm. What makes it really a super game is that it's wonderful for multi-generational groups. So it's perfect for the holidays when you've got a big household of all different ages of kids. So that makes it really fun.
Oh, boy, that does sound like a lot of fun. How many questions comes with an app?
So it comes in with a bunch of different categories.
Okay.
And the idea is that you're trying to get, you know, figure out the word, as many words as you can in a 60-second period.
Okay.
Where the categories that come are there's celebrities, animals, movies, characters. There's a bunch of free that come with the app. But if you find that you really want more than that, you can. There are extra categories that are available as an in-app purchase.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ginny Goodmanson. She is a kid tech columnist for USA Today and the author of the For Dummies book, iPad Apps for Kids. We're talking kids. We're talking about iPad apps in general for family game night. If you have a suggestion or a question for Ginny, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. I would imagine, Ginny, with that game, if it is multi, you know, when you are playing with multi-generations, some of the words some people are going to get and some they're not. So they're just going to sit around and watch, or it'll just be fun to see who gets it.
Right, exactly. And you can, you know, you can choose your categories based on the ages of your kids. I mean, if you got young kids, probably stick with the animals.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, once you're starting to get into actors and celebrities and stuff, that's more of that teen or older age. So it works. You know, it can, you can adjust it because of the categories, by choosing categories. The other fun thing about this one is that it's available for the iOS, which means, you know, iPad, iPod Touch, and the iPhone, but it's also available for Android.
Oh, okay.
All the Android users can play this game as well.
Equal opportunity.
Yes.
Timeline for iPad. This is a history buff game?
Yeah, so this one actually... I was surprised that it was as much fun as it was, because I was thinking, oh, it sounded a little bit, you know, a little bit heavy-duty academic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done a really nice job of putting some gaming into learning some history. So the concept behind this game is, and it can be played with up to four players. Unfortunately, it's only on the iPad, but for those families that have the iPad, it's fun. You get five historic cards dealt to you. And the idea is that you're trying to place your historic cards onto a communal timeline. So it's fascinating because initially, okay, it's not hard to figure out where the discovery of lightning is if there's nothing on the timeline. Where it gets complicated is you might have a card that says, Statue of Liberty, and then you have another one that says the invention of adhesive tape. Okay. Now you're sitting there scratching your head going, I'm not quite sure where that goes. So it's interesting because it leads to a lot of family discussion, and I think it's funny that you think you know where all these things are in history, at least as adults we do.
Mm-hmm.
You find you get into this game and there's a lot to learn.
Is it a team game?
You're playing individually. You can play up to four players. And if you put a card, and the idea is to get rid of your cards. So you're not going to help too much, but we found as a family that, you know, we weren't being too competitive about it. We were actually all trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And so it depends on the family dynamic. I think it's fun to play, you know, either way.
What would you say is the minimum age for this game?
Well, because you got to be, first of all, you got to be able to read.
Yeah.
And you need to know a fair amount. I'm aging it starting at about 8.
Okay. All right.
And then going all the way up again. Yeah.
Marble Mixer.
Okay, so now this is the game if you got a bunch of little kids.
Okay.
And probably maybe skews a little bit towards the boy side of things just because it involves marbles.
Uh-huh.
The girls don't love marbles, but it's a marble shooting game. And so within this game, you have three different options, but they're all involving flicking virtual marbles across the screen, which, as we know, is lots of fun for little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a nice game to pull out, particularly when you're traveling, because that's when you're not going to have a big, heavy bag of marbles. And it's a very much of an action sort of game, so it settles down those kids that sort of get wiggly. It gives them something that really gets them excited and they get involved in, and they actually feel like they're flipping the marble.
So is it just a classic marble?
The classic marble game, you had the ball of string that
right.
You into a ring and you put all your marbles in the middle and then you scoot back and try to shoot them out.
Mm-hmm.
This has actually got some fun aspects to it because, like, one of the variations is called Monster Picnic. And in the center of the iPad, it turns into a rotating green and orange monster with a cute but not scary mouth that opens and closes. And the goal of the game is to flick as many of the colored marbles into that open maw before the time runs out. So, you know, I mean, obviously that's not something that you could create in your real world, and it's fun that technology is creating it for you.
Taking it up a step.
Yeah.
Is it, when you talk about flicking, is it flicking like you flick marbles with that index or not index. Well, I guess it depends on what kind of marble player you are.
You can take your finger on the iPad surface, and this one's also for Android too. So you just kind of move your finger quickly across the surface, and you'll see that the marble underneath your finger moves. It's pretty amazing.
All right, Ticket to Ride gives me the sense that this is another travel app, but not necessarily.
This is based on a very popular board game.
Okay.
I mean, an actual board game. And so this is a what we call porting it over to make it an app. And they actually did a really nice job. And fans of this board game love all the artwork, and it's sort of set in that period when, you know, railroads were really big and everybody traveled by railroad. And this is a game about building a railway empire. And it's a strategy game. You've got cards and you've got secret destinations. And so you're trying to build train lines to your secret destinations from one point on the map to another. And it's a U.S. map. And so it's got good strategy. Kids will actually learn some geography by playing it, because you're going to learn where all these different cities are and what states they are. And the strategy behind it is you're trying to block people from getting, when it appears they're trying to get somewhere, it's a good idea to try to put a railroad line that blocks.
Are you using just one iPad?
Yes, and this one is both iPad and Android.
Okay.
And that's a very good question. This is what I would call a huddle game, meaning you're all huddling around the tablet. And so there are versions for the smaller screen and iPhone, but this is actually a little bit better if you play it on one of the bigger platforms like an Android tablet or an iPad. And it does actually work really well. I mean, it moves around. It recognizes when it's your turn, and it shows you what you need to do. And it's amazing how they've actually come up with really cool technology that allows for the taking of turns and that sort of thing.
So how much do these apps cost?
Well, so that's a good question. Ticket to Ride is $6.99. And that's one of the ones on the higher end, but it's coming from a really sophisticated board game, mm-hmm. and it actually is pretty complicated, so that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Marble Mixer one is 99 cents, mm-hmm. again. So you know, those are the extremes of the pricing. Timeline is $2.99, and Heads Up is 99 cents. So, you know, not going to break the bank on any of these.
Does Ellen DeGeneres get credit for Heads Up?
She does. I mean, they talk about, in the iTunes write-up, it specifically says that it was created and played on the Ellen DeGeneres Show, and she starts the app. I mean, Ellen is the one introducing it to you.
So okay.
She is definitely front and center.
All right. Well, Ginny, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. It was delightful to be here.
Ginny Goodmanson, she's Kid Tech columnist for USA Today and the author of the Four Dummies book, iPad Apps for Kids. Coming up, we have more Tech Tuesday for you. We're going to discuss how companies like Google and Yahoo reacted in the wake of the Snowden NSA leak. So stay with us. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many of the websites and internet services we use every day, from social media to email, news sites, and banking, assume a certain amount of trust. But much of that trust in the promise of privacy was eroded after revelations last year by Edward Snowden that the NSA was spying on us through those sites. Ever since, Google, Facebook, and Yahoo have been at odds with the government, working to restore that trust and secure their businesses here and in other countries. Joining us now by phone from New York to discuss how the tech industry has dealt with the NSA leaks is Stephen Levy, a senior writer at Wired. His recent article is entitled, How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You wrote that when reporters began calling these internet companies for comment about the NSA surveillance, the companies said they didn't think they were involved. How could that be?
Well, they didn't think that they were involved in a program that was being described to them. The first announcement of this came out in some degree of confusion. It happened on June 6th when both the Washington Post and the Guardian used these Snowden leaks to describe this program called PRISM. And it came just a day after the revelation of this other program that the NSA had that basically took the records of every phone call that all Americans made, everything from Verizon and, presumably AT&T and the rest of them there. So people immediately thought, wow, they're reading all our mail there, because the original report said that they went directly to the servers. Now, they had never heard the code name PRISM, these companies did. Mm-hmm. So Google and Facebook and Apple, they all said, what is PRISM? What is PRISM? But they came to realize that it described a program which they did know about, and they had been cooperating about it. They were compelled to cooperate, which made them hand over information to fulfill specific requests from the government, sometimes without warrants, but they were deemed legal, and the companies couldn't talk about these programs there. So that was the first thing that the companies had to deal with, is the revelation of this, which was taken with some degree of misunderstanding. Then a little later, a subsequent Snowden leak revealed that the things that the companies didn't give them, the NSA was basically taking on its own. Specifically, there was a program where the NSA tunneled into the traffic that companies like Google and Yahoo sent amongst themselves through their data centers there. And that's basically pretty much anything that can go on in those companies, all the information stored, all the mail traffic and things like that. The NSA was basically just putting, something in, probing it essentially overseas and sucking up that traffic there. And again, they said the NSA said, it's legal for us to do it, it's overseas, et cetera, et cetera. But the companies felt really betrayed by that, because this was something they didn't know about.
How did they deal with this from a public relations standpoint? When those reporters were calling up and asking these questions, and at first they're saying it's not, we didn't know, or we don't know, or we don't know what you're talking about. Eventually, if we figured out they did.
Right. Well, once it got clear that there was this program, where they were, compelled to provide information there, they emphasized that they were pushing back, that some of them were pushing back to some degree against the program, particularly in the part where they weren't allowed to talk about it there. Mm-hmm. And they were arguing for more transparency about what they did. And they felt that if people knew more about it, they'd feel less threatened. This was the program where they handed stuff over there. But I think essentially they felt that the thing would blow over. They did their own studies, and one company in particular told me that in a couple weeks later, the trust came back up. There was an initial hit, and then people wound up saying, our behavior is not going to change. We're still going to use these services like Facebook or Google or whatever. My argument to them, to get me to cooperate with them, is this isn't over there. And, and they understood that was right. As almost every week there was some new leak, and some of those leaks pointed directly to the companies as a source of information for the NSA.
Can you talk about the difference between the relationship customers have with a telephone company compared to an internet company? Because there seems to be a big difference. We expect our phone numbers or our phones to be tapped, but not our internet internet access.
Well, I don't know if we expect our phone numbers tapped, but it's less of a surprise,
okay,
that a company like Verizon would acquiesce to a government request, not even push back about it, declare it unconstitutional, and fight for their customers, which is what happened with this phone metadata program. That's less surprising than than the tech companies. And then again, it's not so surprising that it was a tech company you know, they tried to fight this in court. Mm-hmm. Yahoo, when they were, you know, first asked to cooperate with this, you know, felt that it was too broad. The prison program was too broad, and they tried to fight it in the secret court, the government court. And, you know, we learned that just this year, that a few years ago, that when the program started, that they pushed back against this. And I think the reason is that these, you know, tech companies, the internet companies, as you said up top, they depend more on the trust of consumers. You don't really have to use them. You don't have to use Facebook. And if you use it, you know, you don't have to share all the information that maybe Facebook would like you to share, that maybe Facebook argues is good for you to share, is good for your life. So they want to make you feel comfortable in doing that. Whereas the phone companies, you know, historically, you just make a call. And, you know, and the idea that the government might be logging what you do, you know, with some equivalent of a PIN register that, you know, takes note of every call and how long the call is, that's not going to make people stop using the phone.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Stephen Levy. He's a senior writer at Wired, talking about his recent article titled How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. If you have a question for Stephen Levy, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. One company went out of business, shut down to avoid giving access to the government.
That's right. You know, now, you know, with these big companies, one thing I wanted to know in talking to them was whether they had to change their infrastructure, change the way they organize their data centers and, you know, the way they handle the information in order to accommodate the government there. And there is sort of a gray area in these regulations that if the government, you know, can't get the information it provides there, you know, how much do the companies have to do? And, you know, because really the government says that they'll pay to a certain degree, you know, to help the companies make those changes to make that happen there. And, you know, all the big companies told me that they did not have to make major changes to their infrastructure to satisfy it. They could, you know, still operate the way they normally operate. And then, you know, if the government says, I want all the traffic from Joe X or whatever, they could provide that. And, you know, sometimes it's by putting equipment on the property of the companies. Other times it's to get, you know, some system where the company gets them the information in a timely manner. But then there was this one company, a mail company called LavaBit, which basically sold itself on privacy. And that was, in effect, was the company that Snowden himself used to, you know, keep his information's secure and ensure to the best he could that the government couldn't snoop on him. And the head of LavaBit said, basically, in order to cooperate with this, I would have to compromise not just, you know, Snowden's privacy, but the privacy of all my companies, because we work on these keys that I'd have to give up there. So rather than do that, rather than compromise on my customers, I'm just going to shut down.
And they did. Whatever happened to them, him?
I think the people in charge of that company are trying to come up with some scheme for a new company that maybe, you know, can operate off that. I talked recently to a woman who an expert in privacy, a woman named Nico Sell, who was starting a company as well. This is a woman who's involved in the annual DEF CON conference there, and she's setting up a secure company. And she says that, you know, she hopes to be able to operate in the United States, but if she gets requests similar to the one like LavaBit did, she would locate offshore. She would not be an American company.
Yeah, a big part of the problem for these tech companies is their overseas business.
Well, definitely. And, you know, and it's important to note that, again, right on the heels of the first announcement there, President Obama was asked about it. And he said, listen, Americans shouldn't worry about this program because, you know, we're really not – this program doesn't allow us to listen in to spy on Americans. It's only on non-Americans, non-U.S. persons there.
Uh-oh.
Well, since these companies do over half their business overseas,
right,
President Obama did not do them a favor by saying that. So a lot of the trust that they have to retain here is from their overseas customers, and it's an important part of their business. I talked to the head of Tumblr, which is now owned by Yahoo, David Karp. And, you know, most of their revenue business is in the United States, but a big part of their game plan is to move that offshore now. And he's worried that as a reaction to the NSA leaks, he's going to have a tougher time doing that as he moves into Europe.
Now, yeah, some countries already, not Western, but is it Brazil, Argentina?
Brazil, the balkanization.
Yes, they want to balkanize. They want to, that if you, once you leave the country, you don't have access to your own data anymore.
Right. Yeah, so, this interestingly, was when I talked to Mark Zuckerberg, for the article. This was his biggest worry, that, what is known as the balkanization of the internet, into what David Drummond, the head of one of the heads of Google, called the splinternets. So basically, the idea would be that a country would be so worried about overseas snooping and control of overseas, and particularly by the U.S., is that they would pass laws or regulations saying that if their citizens use a service, the citizens' information would have to stay within the borders. It would be stored there on servers inside those borders. And Brazil, in particular, has been very aggressive in pursuing this. Now, as I looked into this, I found that this wasn't a new idea, this idea of balkanization and, kind of localized servers. And in the past, it had been argued about more like a protectionist thing, saying we don't want these overseas companies, particularly American companies, taking the business of our citizens there. Mm-hmm. But the NSA leaks have given new energy to this argument, which really hadn't been taken off in the past. And in countries like Brazil and even Germany, people are seriously considering it.
Companies have been turning to better encryption of data for some protection for their users. Has that been a realistic solution?
Well, definitely in terms of the kinds of programs that that Google and Yahoo were subject to suck up the data traffic overseas, this can help there. And as a matter of fact, the good people at Google told me that that program, the leaks of the Snowden came said that that they were having success in that program and getting the traffic. They said that program won't work anymore with them because now that they've fully implemented a program that Google had put underway even earlier to encrypt that traffic there, to code it, so that if someone took the traffic, they couldn't read it very, very easily. They'd have to undergo a very expensive and time-consuming process of cryptanalysis. Yahoo is a little behind in this, but they've announced that they're going to do it too. And one of the most interesting things that I found in talking to the security people at companies like Google and Facebook and Yahoo was that they now consider their number one adversary to be the United States government. And I just thought that was mind-blowing to me, that these American companies, really our flagship companies in the 21st century, now consider their own government as kind of a foe.
It's a fine balance, though, because they also, the U.S. government is a customer of theirs as well, right?
That's right. And one thing that I do mention in there is when it comes to cooperating with programs like PRISM, and determining how hard they're going to push back against it, there is always, lurking in the background the idea that these companies, too, have complex relationships with governments. So on one hand, that some of them are under scrutiny for their own privacy practices or antitrust issues and things like that. And they don't want to tick off the government too much that, some folks at the top might say, well, let's unleash the dogs of regulation on these folks for not cooperating with us. And then other companies have contracts with the government. They do business with the government. One high executive at one of these companies, someone who's very familiar with the situation, told me that, it's not a foremost thing, but it's in the back of your mind. You're saying, is not cooperating going to cost us a $400 million contract with the government?
Has there been a measurable economic impact to these companies?
That's a little fuzzy. There are people, analysts who say that this is going to cost the companies many billions of dollars. We see some reports here and there from some equipment makers saying they've already found that, their overseas business is hurt there. And I think some of the problems are going to come not just from these big companies and winning their business, but some of these smaller companies are just gaining traction now. A company like Dropbox, mm-hmm. whose business is to urge individuals and companies to store their data in the cloud on the servers belonging to Dropbox. And there's all sorts of efficiencies that come of this, but there's also now the worry that this information could be spied upon. So as these businesses try to win overseas customers, mm-hmm. This could be a real concern.
Yeah, and the startups will have the harder time of it.
Definitely, particularly if the balkanization things happen.
Right.
Some of the bigger companies could, it'll cost them, millions, maybe billions of dollars to deal with it. But a small company couldn't even hope to operate globally, to overcome that sort of barrier there. And and that really is what makes the internet so attractive. I guess that's why my, article had this title there. It's not like the internet's going to go dark, but what this could affect is the open nature, the borderless nature of the internet, and also the spirit of the internet there. The internet was once thought as a very empowering phenomenon, maybe the most empowering one in our lifetimes now. And some people are now worried that it's going to turn into mainly a tool for surveillance.
What are the tech companies lobbying for in Washington? Are they asking for changes in the surveillance laws?
They definitely are. They're definitely getting very involved now with the pending legislation, and they've had multiple meetings with the administration and even the president. A month ago, the president wanted to have a meeting with the tech leaders, mainly to talk about the healthcare website and how to fix that and how to make the information infrastructure of healthcare better. But the tech leaders basically hijacked that meeting. They said that's not what we want to talk about. We want to talk about this issue with the NSA. And indeed, that's what that meeting was about.
And any results from that yet?
I think we're going to find out on Friday. On Friday, President Obama is going to announce his decision on what he's going to do with this issue. He put together a review panel last summer. It was relatively conservative. It had some people who were involved in privacy, but also some people who were fairly hardcore national security people. Mm-hmm. And they came out with a 300-page report with 46 recommendations, some of which would be pretty significant there. And we're waiting to see what President Obama is going to adopt from that list and whether he's going to go beyond it or do less or what. He's indicated that he's going to do something, but really we don't know the extent of the changes that he's willing to demand from the NSA.
I was startled, impressed, but took note of the fact that the head of the NSA actually talked with you.
Yeah, I was, very happy about that.
Yeah.
I wrote a book about cryptography and, the NSA's role in, dealing with this relatively new phenomenon of cryptography in the public sector, which really sprang up as a result of a couple of amazing inventions by outsiders in the 1970s there. And there was this thing, people dubbed it the crypto wars in the 90s. And I spent the better part of the decade writing about it. My very first story for Wired Magazine, when I was still working freelance, was the second cover story. It was about these people called cypherpunks, and I covered this whole phenomenon during the 90s, wrote a book about it that came out in 2001, early 2001, but never crossed what's known as the triple fence, never crossed the fences of the NSA. They never let me in. I finally did win some interview, but they made me do it right off outside the grounds in a museum, the Cryptologic Museum. And this time, it showed, I guess, how concerned the NSA was that they let me in. And, I had an extensive interview with top officials, including for a period the very top guy, General Keith Alexander.
Well, Stephen Levy, maybe we'll be talking to you again to unpack whatever the president has to say later this week.
No, that'd be great. So thanks very much for your conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen Levy. He's a senior writer at Wired. His recent article is entitled How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back with talk about some of the coolest gadgets to come out of last week's Consumer Electronics Show. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, tech companies from around the globe gathered in Las Vegas to show off their latest innovations. Joining us to discuss some of that new technology and other news is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. So it was the Consumer Electronics Show, right?
That was it.
And in general, how is this year's show? Impressive? Not so impressive?
You know, when we talked about this last year, one of the big concerns that you and I talked about was that, you know, a lot of the bigger companies, Microsoft and Samsung and these companies were kind of pulling out of the Consumer Electronics Show mm-hmm. and hosting their own events for these kind of large presentations that they would give. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we saw at this show. There were a couple of things that were impressive, but none that were, you know, like the single biggest thing of the show. And while that's probably a good thing because it means that you get to you know, wander around and explore everything or as close to everything as you could possibly manage, it does kind of make you wonder how the show is going to continue over the next couple of years.
Now, the car companies were there, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. There was a ton of automotive technology. And one of the really fun things that we're going to see over the next 2 years is companies like Google and Apple working with automotive companies to make our cars and our phones play nicer together than they do right now, which is going to be really, really cool stuff. But nothing real as far as that goes has happened yet.
PlayStation Now is something that they brought out. What did Sony? What's new under the sun with that?
So Sony had a service that they purchased called Gaikai. The idea was that it was this game streaming service where you purchased a game and then instead of installing the game on something and then playing it, you were actually streaming the game over the internet where you had a controller in your hand and when you moved left on the controller, it was actually sending that signal over the internet to a server and telling that server to move left. And then in you know, as close to lightning fast as you could possibly get, you know, the video that you would see would respond as though you were playing a game console sitting right in front of you. There have been a couple of different companies that have tried this so far. None of them have been hugely successful. But Sony purchased Gaikai with the hopes of dumping a bunch of money into it and making it a really powerful service. And they've rebranded that service to what they are now calling PlayStation Now and announced that it's going to be available this summer. And the demonstrations that they gave for it were really impressive. They had just a regular PlayStation DualShock controller connected to a television, you know, just a smart television. And it was able to play PlayStation 3 games as though there was a console plugged into it. It was really impressive.
What's a DualShock controller?
This is the name that Sony has for their controllers. The DualShock refers to the vibration motor that's inside of it, the kind of response kick that it gives when you do certain things in the game.
Are you playing with one now?
Not right this second.
All right. What did you make of it? Did you get to try it out, or
this is something that they're going to have as a closed beta soon that I'll be able to participate in? So I haven't actually touched it yet, but I have colleagues who played with it for a while, and there's plenty of video on the internet right now of people who got to try it during CES, and it was as close to flawless as you could get. Now, granted, that was an environment where Sony had control of every single point, so it's going to be flawless. But just the ability to play, high quality PlayStation 3 games, even like, you know, games that just came out really for the PlayStation 3 on something as low powered, comparably low powered as a television or your smartphone is a really impressive concept.
So, all right. Okay, so the idea is that we're moving away from then the, we're moving into that mode now where you can just, all you have to do is carry around your DualShock controller and you're good to go?
Well, I think it creates a different category of video game player. Okay. I think that, you know, it takes the casual gamer and invites them to, you know, spend money on a game in the same way that you would spend money on a game for your phone. You know, where you'd spend $5 or $10 and you know, get a game for your phone and play the game for a while and put it away. Or what Sony really wants people to do is to pay for a subscription where you get kind of a Netflix-style access to all of the games that are on Gaikai, or I'm sorry, on PlayStation Now, and then you're able to play them on whatever you want. And the cool thing about PlayStation Now as an online service is it gives you the ability to play it on a smartphone, on a PlayStation Vita. You can play it on a console if you want. And the demonstration they gave with the, you know, with just a smart TV was really impressive.
I mean, do you see people doing this on the airplane, traveling across the country?
Unfortunately, the big thing here is that it requires a dedicated internet connection in order for PlayStation Now to work. So it has to have at least a 5 megabit connection. So something like an airplane is just not going to happen unless they figure out some kind of offline mode. But I don't think that that's a reasonable thing to assume anytime soon. But as far as being able to play, you know, in a hotel room when you've gone somewhere, you know, it wouldn't be crazy to see, you know, you walk into a hotel room and see a DualShock controller sitting on the bed next to the remote control, giving you the ability to play PlayStation Now when you check into the hotel. That's the thing that could actually happen.
Okay, because I was going to ask, who's going to lug around a DualShock controller with them all over the place?
But, the controller part is, I mean, they're really generic. You can, you know, play DualShock controllers are really inexpensive, so they can be kind of anywhere.
Okay. All right. Do they need to be plugged into the devices, like smartphones and tablets?
No, it's a Bluetooth connection. Okay. You know, obviously there could be some that require a physical connection, but most of it's Bluetooth.
All righty. Well, let's move on to Razer's Project Christine. What is it?
Razer, you have to understand first that Razer is a crazy, crazy company. They focus on video game-focused hardware, and Razer's hardware has a tendency to look really futuristic and very shiny and glossy with lots of blacks and greens. And they work really hard to kind of create these advanced concepts that may or may not actually become products later on.
Okay.
And last year they did this, and everything that they announced as part of their kind of concept programs became actual products later last year. And Project Christie is kind of an attempt to refresh the desktop by making all of the bits and pieces inside of the desktop really, really rapidly removable and accessible. So what you see with the Project Christie prototype is this tower that looks more like a very small condensed server rack, where each of these individual parts can be kind of removed and you know, other things can be slotted in. And the idea here is that when parts of your computer need to be upgraded, instead of going through the trouble of building your own computer and you know, kind of putting together what you think is the perfect case, when something gets upgraded, you can really just kind of pull out one cartridge and stick another cartridge in. And whether or not this actually becomes a product or not is almost irrelevant. What it shows is Razer looking at, you know, ways to make the desktop more interesting, because a lot of people are kind of drifting away from desktop gaming as far as, using a traditional desktop to do much of anything outside of a work environment. So it was really interesting to see, Razer trying to keep the desktop interesting by looking at this kind of modular computing project.
And it's a subscription type service.
The idea is that you would pay for, you know, a subscription to Project Christie, and then when new things came out, they just sent them to you. You know, so when you decided that you wanted a graphics upgrade, instead of looking for what you thought was the best graphics upgrade and then purchasing it and then installing it, you just had the next graphics upgrade and you just stuck it in the slot on the computer.
Okay. I guess we should move on to Sony 4K Ultra Short Throw Projector.
This is something that is going to be an actual product. This is something Sony has done really crazy things over the last couple of years with 4K equipment. They were one of the first companies to kind of push the technology out, and you see a lot of their projectors in theaters now. When you see theaters advertising 4K projectors for their theaters or Ultra HD projectors for their theaters, most of the time they're Sony hardware. And what Sony did here was create this really high-end projector that you can put in your house. And instead of, you know, mounting behind you in kind of a weird, awkward way, mm-hmm. they created this short throw projector that kind of looks like an entertainment center that sits maybe half a foot from your wall and can still project, up to 120-inch screen on your wall.
Didn't we talk about this last year?
No, we talked about a regular 4K projector that was made by another company. And what was crazy about it was that, you know, this single 4K projector last year, a lot of them got kind of pricey. And what we were looking at was, you know, kind of, $9,000 or $10,000 projectors that are kind of expensive. This does absolutely nothing to decrease the price. It, in fact, increases it threefold. this projector entertainment center is $30,000.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it is no. I mean, there's no one is no no one.
No one we know is getting one. Yeah,
is going to own one. But the idea was really cool because it was the entire entertainment center.
So why make something so expensive when most companies are focusing on making TVs cheaper?
Well, Sony's focus here isn't so much making the television more expensive as focusing on how the living room can be improved. And the idea of a short throw projector, you know, gives the advantages of a projector, which, you know, is, you know, better colors in a lot of instances and more kind of theater quality experiences. But this particular design solves the most obnoxious part of having a projector in your house, which is, you know, the light that gets in the way, having someone else walk through the room and kind of walk through the projector as they're doing things, or having, you know, trouble mounting or anything like that. This you know, design solves a lot of those problems. And like everything Sony does, the first iteration is prohibitively expensive.
All right. Can you just go back up just a second, explain what we mean by 4K?
Sure. So right now, a lot of people who have high definition televisions have what is called true HD, which is a 1080p display. It's 1080 pixels across. And what 4K sets, there's 4K and Ultra HD sets are roughly four times that resolution. So it is the next step beyond an HD TV in terms of home entertainment.
And are projectors going to become more common in the home because of technology like this? I mean, do you see it?
Yeah, every year, every time a new technology like this comes out, there is a hope that that will happen. But I don't think that it's realistically going to happen. You know, the 4K projectors are not wholly different from regular projectors. And the problem that you run into with a lot of these is that in order for them to be bright enough to take to, you know, combat the sun, mm-hmm. when you have windows open and things like that, they get really, really expensive because the bulbs get really pricey, and then they get difficult to replace if the bulbs burn out because they're so bright and they're so expensive. So it is a great concept for someone who wants that kind of theater experience in their home, but I don't think that it is, you know, going to replace the you know, the box that sits on your wall or sits on your entertainment center anytime soon.
Have you seen the Hunger Games movies?
I have seen the first of the Hunger Games movies. I haven't seen the second one.
Well, I mean, they use projection for their TVs. That's what they are. They're like little projectors.
Yeah.
Is that what this is like?
This is similar. Instead of projecting into a blank space, it does have to project onto a physical wall.
Okay.
Whereas the displays that you saw in Hunger Games were really kind of more holographic in their design.
Okay.
So it's not the basic technology is still there.
Do you ever watch movies and just completely deconstruct them based on the technology and say, that couldn't happen, that's ridiculous?
My wife hates watching television shows with me now because I can actually point out what phone each person in the show is using. I've been thrown out of the living room more than once because I've been like, oh, that guy's got an HTC One, or, you know, that guy's got an iPhone 5S. I can't help it. So, yes, movies are the exact same thing where I break down. It's fortunate that we have, you know, this really kind of rich science fiction group right now with Marvel and like the Avengers and Iron Man and stuff, where a lot of the technology just kind of doesn't exist. It just sounds really sciencey. So, you know, we get really excited about it, but a lot of the technology isn't there yet. So I don't get in so much trouble with movies as I do television shows.
Okay.
But I have been thrown out of the living room at least once in the last week.
That's great. Gosh, you must be irritating. It's all good out. But once again, I appreciate you, Russell. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.